from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Gavin Newsom thinks hackers may be the key to good government. California's lieutenant governor and San Francisco's former mayor says officials are often hampered by old equipment and policies. But he thinks the tech community can step in and create apps for better bus schedules, carpooling systems, and the tracking of your tax dollars, among other things. Lieutenant Governor Newsom joins us to talk about his new book. It's called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. We'll also talk to him about his push to keep jobs in California and his reportedly rocky relationship with Governor Jerry Brown. That's next on Forum, after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Former two-term San Francisco mayor, founder of 15 Bay Area Small Businesses, and present California Lieutenant Governor Gavin Newsom joins us in studio for this morning's opening Forum Hour. He recently resigned from his role as the host of a television program on Current Television, the network sold by former Vice President Al Gore and his partner Joel Hyatt to Al Jazeera. And Gavin Newsom also recently published a book called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. We welcome him back to our studios for this Forum Hour.
Good Thanks, Michael. In fact, yeah, the book comes out today, so I actually can get a few copies myself. I've been holding the same one for a week, so I'm looking forward.
Well, you had galleys, though, didn't you?
Yeah, galleys, but you know, it's not the same as actually. No. I mean, you've written a lot of books. This is new to me, so I've spent the last year and a half focused on the topic of technology and governance as opposed to technology and campaigns. We do such an effective job, relatively speaking, of using the tools of technology to amplify people's voices, to raise money, to get them to volunteer, and certainly show up on election day. But boy, once the election's over, you know, you kind of miss them because they disappear, politicians. All of a sudden, those voices are turned off. They're not amplified. And we don't have kind of civic engagement that we otherwise could and should if we flip this around. And so my book sort of explores that disconnect and how we can fill that gap.
Talk to you about the book, though you remind me of the fact that the Obama machinery in terms of using technology the first time around was extraordinary, and you tried doing it in the gubernatorial campaign that you launched. It didn't work so well for Obama the second time around. Somehow he couldn't get the traction or didn't get the thing started.
Well,
he did.
You know, he had 35,000 self-organized communities in mybarackobama.com, which was essentially a fancy email campaign. At the time, it was an extraordinary campaign. What he did was the framework for what he did even better this last election with technology. But you recall, right after that election, people said they were so motivated, so enthusiastic, they wanted to continue the conversation. But all of a sudden, the Obama administration realized, boy, a conversation now is a two-way conversation, not a one-way broadcast conversation. And they realized this quickly after the election when they created a program called Change.org. And they solicited ideas about what they should prioritize. Think about 2008, a war on terror, war in Iraq, war in Afghanistan, issues of climate change, fiscal calamity all around us. So looking forward, the president had a town hall, and he went to the net and he asked folks what was their priority. Overwhelming priority was legalize marijuana. He made a flippant remark about that infamously, and that was not well received by the community. As a consequence, they turned off the site, never to have it reopen until the election started gearing up and the new iteration of mybarackobama.com was put in place for this last campaign.
But that could be where participatory democracy and the kind of participatory democracy you're advocating can go, right?
That's it. You got to be careful what you wish for. You've seen it with these petition sites they put together, right? People saying, let's do a Death Star. A member of the White House said, we'll respond to any petition over 5,000. And then they said, no, that threshold's too low because now we have to deal with guys like, well, a CNN newscaster that's focused on gun control and whether or not to deport them. So they raised the threshold to 25. Now they want to raise the threshold to whether or not they respond even higher. Meaning this is tough stuff. If you want to have a real conversation, you better be willing to actually follow through and have a substantive two-way conversation. But from my perspective in the business world, and as you note, I've got close to 1,000 employees. One thing I've learned the hard way is a top-down, hierarchical, one-way conversation with my customers is no longer relevant to the world they're living in and we're living in. That's coming the way of government, and we better wake up to that reality.
talk about this from government as well as entrepreneurship. First, let me talk to you about a few other things that are particularly something that's been in the news a lot. Rick Perry actually going on a radio broadcast and talking about how business people here in California should go to Texas because they'll be much more welcome and they'll be greeted and treated well and all that sort of thing. And this is the radio ad, actually, that went out to convince California businesses to come to Texas.
Building a business is tough, but I hear building a business in California is next to impossible. This is Texas Governor Rick Perry, and I have a message for California businesses. Come check out Texas. There are plenty of reasons Texas has been named the best state for doing business for 8 years running. Visit TexasWideOpenForBusiness.com and see why our low taxes, sensible regulations, and fair legal system are just the thing to get your business moving to Texas.
Well, that was a radio ad from Texas Governor Rick Perry. California Governor Jerry Brown had a quick response on Monday. He called Perry's $26,000 radio buyout a big nothing, and he said, it's not a serious story, guys. It's barely a fart. Now, this has become kind of a strange and almost fervent competition in some ways. Well, it's like the Dodgers and the Giants. I mean, I noticed Sacramento Bee came out with an editorial, and they said, Texas is one in toxic chemicals into the water. Texas is number one in executions. But, I mean, first of all, I didn't know that the governor would be talking about flatulence, but
it was inartful. I prefer his Latin to his English. But that said, look, Perry's getting exactly what he wanted. He got exactly what he wanted just a second ago. He's getting all the free publicity. There was a $25,000 or so buy, pretty modest, but he's getting all kinds of press up and down the state. And why? Well, because he's leaning in. He's in the game. He's getting in our heads. He was here in December down in San Diego. He's coming here in San Francisco, I think, as early as Monday. And he's marketing himself. Now, look, at the end of the day, it's not a good economic development strategy to put that kind of energy and attention. It's less than 2% of the net job gains in any particular state when you look at all the objective analysis. The biggest investment we should be making is retention and internal and organic growth, but it doesn't get as much attention itself. So it's about marketing.
And didn't you say we're cleaning their clock in jobs?
Well, we are. In the last year and a half, California has substantially outpaced Texas in terms of job creation. And I think there's a lot of mythology about people leaving the state. It's an interesting fact. In 2010, 1.6% of people left Texas. In California, 1.5%. Well, the difference was their population grew only because they had more people coming into the state than California. But people that are there have a higher percentage of folks that actually want to leave after they spend a little time. That said, I think Texas is a fabulous place. I love Austin. I love the metro areas in that state. They are dynamic economic centers, but they don't come close to California in terms of our economic ingenuity, innovation, and entrepreneurial spirit. Think about this. We have more scientists, more researchers, more engineers, more patents emanating out of the state, more venture capital, three of the top six universities on the planet, public universities here in California. This is the birthplace of biotech, life science, nanotechnology. We're on the leading edge of synthetic biology and genomics, leading edge of robotics and sensors and artificial intelligence. And we're part of the Pacific Rim, and the fate and future of our world is going to be related to our ability to expand east, so to the rest of the world from Western perspective. So I get what he's doing. I wish, by the way, we did a little bit more of this. You know, be nice. They have Austin Chamber has 24/7. They're casing our joint. Austin Chamber of Commerce has multiple offices in California. So does Virginia. Other states have been doing this for years. The Louisiana governor's been out a bunch. Colorado governor's been out a bunch. I don't know many trips where Californians are going out making a case for our state, and I think it'd be a good thing to do.
You just did perception. It right here on the air. We're on Sirius, and there are people listening to us all over the country.
Yeah,
here, but,
no good.
What about this reported rocky relationship, as some describe it? You just said the governor was inartful in the way he described the—
Well, that's— I don't— it's but not
that,
a word
notwithstanding that, no. But, you know, I mean, you've criticized him before on this program and so forth. How are you getting along these days?
I'm getting along. I mean, it's amazing. You know, maybe I'm so used to local government. Much thinner skin in state and federal government. I mean, it was more hand-to-hand combat here in San Francisco. I became used to—
I was asking you before you came in the air whether you miss Chris Daley and Peston.
Yeah, but you know, you look back. I mean, it wasn't little leagues. It seemed to be bigger leagues in terms of your ability to navigate that and still wake up every day and lean into your job. But at the state, you know, all I said, I think, in the last time on the show, I said Jerry Brown's doing an outstanding job. I think was the exact words on solvency. But what we need is a vision for greatness, and people found that a great offense. I saw about 10 articles on that. People said, "Oh, Brown's being attacked." By the lieutenant governor. It seems pretty modest. I've always said I wanted to be the most successful governor. I've consistently praised him for the work he's done on the budget. He deserves all the praise in the world. I think he's doing an outstanding job. But my one point of focus has consistently been, and it's a bias of mine, I get it. You noted my private sector background, the work I did as mayor to try to make San Francisco viable from an economic perspective. It's the work I'm doing at the state. I put together an economic development plan. I traveled to South Korea to make a case to get Samsung to come out to California. I traveled all over the rest of this nation to look at best practices in economic development, including visiting with Rick Perry, God forbid, to learn a little bit about their Texas One model, this public-private partnership they have that I think is an interesting model for California. And I just like to see us do a little bit more on jobs because we have 1.8 million people unemployed. We still have the third highest unemployment in America at 9.7%. Imperial County's at 25.5%. You can't make that up. Colusa County's not far behind. Meanwhile, you have counties like Marin at 5.5%. So we have two different Californians, even though we're living in the same state. And I think we need to reconcile that, reconcile our poverty issues, and get serious about job creation and job retention. And I think Governor Brown is more than capable of doing that. I just want to see him in the next 2 years put the kind of energy he put in the last 2 years on the issue of the budget, put it in the issue of jobs and the economy.
You've also said, in fact, I was looking on your website and you were talking about your economic development plan and you were saying that gross domestic product growth is down, that we really need to do something about growth other than in the central areas. I mean, growth is really sort of in your sights to a big time.
Well, you want to solve problems. You know, you can't – here's my bias. And, you know, I'm a progressive person. Heck, I was out on the death penalty trying to repeal it, one of the few statewide – in fact, I think it was the only statewide official that came out supporting the repeal of the death penalty. Supporting the Three Strikes Initiative, called for legalization of marijuana. I've certainly been, you know, some folks have identified me with issues of marriage equality and certainly been leaning into that.
Some folks.
Okay. But, you know, I say all that to say
modest
this.
Modest statement.
But I'm going to say this at the same time with the same kind of energy and conviction of, in terms of my progressive perspectives, is you can't be pro-job and anti-business. And the way to solve so many of our problems, name the problem, is to create more revenue. And you can't tax or cut your way to prosperity. You've got to grow your way. And that's not just a Republican cheap line. I really believe that. And we're not focusing on that growth part. It's an interesting fact, Michael. Between 1950 and 1980, California was a tentpole for the American economy. We grew at 3.7% on an annual rate. The nation at a relatively modest 2.2%. But what's happened since 1980 to 2010 is we've flatlined from 3.7% those previous three decades to the last three decades at 1.1%. The nation at 1.2%, they're actually outperforming the nation as a whole, California. So we become average. And I don't want to be average. This state's not about being average. So we've got to lean in. It's nice to get the cyclical benefits of the macroeconomic turndown as America does better. California always does a little bit better. So we can say we're growing at a faster rate than everybody else. But we're going to hit a point where there's a structural imbalance that we have to fix. And what I'm arguing for is to deal with that structural issue, get into the plumbing on what is holding back the economic opportunities of the state that defined the best of the state in the 50s, 60s, and 70s.
Well, Republicans would say, and I should mention that Lieutenant Governor Newsom actually says nice things in his book about the Tea Party. but the Republicans would say, in fact, they're holding up the sign in Texas, Proposition 30. You know, this is the, what's going to lure business people supposedly to the Lone Star
State. Arizona was the first out. They did a whole marketing campaign and billboards. Look, I have a good friend of mine, a big CEO in Silicon Valley, who said, hey, I got a call from the governor. I said, well, what did Jerry say? He said, no, it wasn't Jerry Brown. I said, well, what was the conversation? He said, well, governor was asking me if I received a package. And I hadn't received it, but apparently the governor had sent me a package. In there was an iPhone with a single cell phone number, and the single cell phone number was back to his office. And in that cell phone was a beautiful video in the smartphone of all the economic opportunities in their state. Now, that didn't cost the governor much. That's not a big expense. In fact, found out it came from the private sector, that money for that initiative. They had sent hundreds of those out all across the country. You know, those are the kind of things that as a business person, heck, those are things I need to do to get customers and get attention. That's what Rick Perry, so that's part of what I admire about some of these folks. At least they're in the game and they're trying to get in our head. Is he right on the facts? Absolutely not. And give me a break, CEO Magazine, with all due respect. They're the ones that have said for 8 years we're the worst place to do business and Texas is the best place. But you know what? I've called their editors 2 years in a row. They refuse to give us the criteria to which they make that determination or the group that they actually solicit, 650 or so random CEOs. I'd love to know a little bit about what their criteria because it's just utter gobbledygook.
Get back to your book. You sort of started this talking to my old friend Stuart Brand about white hat hackers and getting into the idea that maybe hacking is good for democracy.
By the way, Stuart says nice things in the book about the Tea Party, too. And by the way, we both come from the frame of I like people to step up and step in. I don't agree with the Tea Party on, well, anything. But I really admire people that actually get out and step into a debate and participate in it. And one thing you cannot deny about the Tea Party is their influence. And
now, here's the
nice
thing that I found myself in reading your book coming back to. To get participatory democracy, to get people out there using their apps and, you know, talking about potholes and what there should be on Muni and all those kinds of things and really becoming – I mean, that's really your thesis, if I can take the crystallization of it forward here. But I kept thinking about just – the general apathy of citizens. I mean, I remember we did a program, you weren't mayor, Frank Jordan was mayor, did a program at City Hall and talked to people who simply didn't vote and said, why didn't you vote? We got all these people, rounded them up together, and they said, I don't think my franchise is worth very much. I don't think it makes a difference.
Yeah.
And everything. So you can get people to be participatory. You got to get them engaged.
You know, it's the book begins with L.A., major L.A. race last year. 12% of people actually registered. I mean, literally 12% of those registered decided to show up to vote, and it wasn't even a headline. It was barely even captured in the media because the previous election, 13% of people decided to vote, the second largest city in America. So you're absolutely right. Why vote if you're a young person?
That to its extension. Why become involved in a participatory way?
Because like people are. Well, here's a couple thoughts. First of all, people vote like and dislike dozens, sometimes 100 times a day. And they go on, watch these shows, American Idol and others, and they're voting dozens of times for folks. America's Got Talent literally allows you to vote 50, 60 times. So then we ask them to vote once every 2 years in a most, analog way. You've got to, apparently you go to a DMV to get registered until recently in California, until we finally went online after years and years of trailing other states. I would say go to a post office. People say, what's a post office? Young folks to register, and then you're given a limited period of time to do it, and you go into
a
Berkeley,
fire station. They're saying, what's a post office?
Yeah, no, but I mean, just think about it. Think about the world that our kids are living in. And, you know, I thought I had a prodigy. I have this 3-year-old. She's 3 and a half now. And I watch her on my iPad. I think, man, this is something special. And then I've got her at this Ola preschool, and everybody there is a prodigy. And I realized, well, maybe she's not a prodigy. Maybe these digital natives are growing up digital. Have a completely different perspective where you can't educate my daughter, you can't educate this next generation, and nor can you engage this next generation or this current generation as we've tried to engage them in the past. Here's the good news. They're more empathetic, this millennial generation, more engaged peer-to-peer than any generation in history. But they're taking matters in their own hands. They're going to Donors Choose as opposed to waiting in line up in Sacramento to get into a hearing that's dominated by the persuasion industry, lobbyists, and special interests. They're rather doing direct connections on Kiva.org or going to Indiegogo or jumpstarting their opportunities to raise money and support causes they believe in with Kickstarter. And so that's the disconnect.
These are the ones that are involved, though.
But this generation, this is not as – and I take them on modestly, but I wish I could take them on even more. Malcolm Gladwell calls this the slacker generation. He's just missed the point, and the objective facts bear it out. He loves being the contrarian, and he got a lot of attention for that, but he's wrong. This is a whole new generational shift. You've seen it in media. It's just flattened the media industry. You understand that better than anybody. You've seen it in the music industry. No one saw that coming. Just completely flattened. You're seeing it. You're going to see it in the financial industry. Heck, I'm wearing a wearable medical device right now from my friends at Jawbone, which tells me how much I've slept, how many calories I've burned, et cetera. You're going to start seeing it dramatically in the health industry.
Deepak Chopra was out a few weeks ago. I had the same device, by the way.
Yeah, no, it's my point
being. But you guys aren't millennials.
No, we're not millennials. But the point is things are changing dramatically. You're a friend of Tom Friedman. You've interviewed him. You know, I did an interview with him at an economic development summit we sponsored in Santa Clara a few months back. And he had a wonderful line. It just summed it up. I put it in the book. He said, you know, in 2005, when he wrote The World is Flat, when he coined the term The World is Flat, he said, 2005, that's not that long ago. He said, Facebook wasn't even in there. Twitter was a sound. The cloud was in the sky. 4G was a parking space. LinkedIn was a prison. Apps were things you filled out to get into the University of San Francisco. And Skype, for most of us, was a typo. Those things are ubiquitous in our lives. They didn't exist as we know them. I think of the drone.
Where the hell are we going to be 5 years from now?
That's the point. So we have to wake up. We're kind of a tsunami of change. Government is still in the analog world. We're still in silos. We have IT departments. We haven't even gone to the cloud. And yet the world is operating at a completely different pace. And so for me, it's the new digital divide. And we've got to reconcile that. And in Citizenville, I lay out not just the problem, but we go local and we see Democrats and Republicans. That's why I want to be fair. I want to look where the facts are, doing remarkable things with technology to engage citizens and bring back the de Tocqueville sort of framework of the town hall, the township, this wonderful spirit of American democracy.
And you believe that this can diminish the partisanship and really the excessive partisanship that we have?
Yeah, I'm so, you know, as much as I love it, you know, because I participate sometimes in it, who's to blame? It's just so trivial at the end of the day. I want to focus on what to do. I don't care who's up or down. I want to actually get things done. You know, in the book, we talk about, in fact, you brought up Stuart Brand, who's really one of the, you know, I mean, my God.
In fact, you interview a lot of people in this book.
68 people.
Yeah.
From President Clinton to Gore. We started with them saying, what would reinvent government in 1992 look like with the tools of technology of 2012? But we meet with the origins of technological revolutions and open government and those white hackers and guys like Stuart Brand that were there with Jobs in the early days. And, you know, Stuart coined the phrase personal computer and came up with the idea that information wants to be free.
He founded the Well. He founded the Whole Earth Catalog.
One of the – just a living legend. And he's in our own backyard and so many other legends in the making that we met with, from Code for America, Jen Polka and Tim O'Reilly on the Government 2.0 initiatives. But change agents. Democrats and Republicans. Eric Cantor, we say some nice things about his team, Matt Lara, doing some really interesting citizen engagement that's nonpartisan and substantive. So the point is, I'm optimistic, but technology is dramatically leveling hierarchy. And we are in a very top-down hierarchical phase. And President Obama is learning this yet again the hard way with this incredible insistence of secrecy on the issue of drones. I mean, you can't make it up. We're living in a glass house. We're living in a fishbowl. And yet the president's still arguing to deny the obvious, even to those that are mandated with oversight.
Well, he did release. Until he was forced. Yeah.
And that doesn't build trust. Even though the American people overwhelmingly support the drone initiative, it just inures to less trust and goes to your question. Why are people not engaged in government? Because they don't have that trust. Even if they like the president and like the drones, they don't like the secrecy. And that's what's got to be changed.
Well, I think you said, I was reading an interview you did in Salon.com, privacy as we know it is all but dead.
You know, I believe transparency and privacy go hand in hand. But it's and what I mean by that is there has to be informed consent. And there's not the informed consent as it relates to your privacy today. Those digital natives, I'm a digital immigrant. I'm learning the language. But those digital immigrants, young folks, they've led their digital breadcrumbs for an entire generation, their entire lives. And they're not as caught up in this issue as folks like me that are sort of going through this, less perhaps as a politician than a lot of folks in the private sector. I would be willing to pay maybe a dollar or two to provide or to get that extra service, where a young person, actually, they're happy to say where they are, their location, and get notifications and allow that information to be used because they want it free. But it has to be informed. So it's all about, for me, transparency and informed consent as it relates to protecting privacy, but recognizing that privacy, as we've known it certainly in the past, is dead.
Talking with Gavin Newsom, former mayor of San Francisco, now lieutenant governor of the state of California, who with Lisa Dickey has put out a book called Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. And you can join us in this conversation. We invite you to do so. Our toll-free number is available right now, 866-733-6786. Again, toll-free from anywhere, 866-733-6786, or email us, forum@kqed.org, or go to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment or our Facebook page. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're spending the hour with former San Francisco Mayor Gavin Newsom, who is now Lieutenant Governor of California. And the proper address, as I learned years ago with Leo McCarthy, for Lieutenant Governor is Governor. So he's Governor Newsom now.
My first job, this is the irony, I got in a lot of trouble for being a little flippant, which never is good in politics, by saying, I don't know what the heck a lieutenant governor does. The irony of that comment was I knew exactly what a lieutenant governor did because I got a paid internship when I was at Santa Clara University with Leo McCarthy in his lieutenant governor's office, one of the great legends. And really, I think just a model in terms of what a lieutenant governor should and can do.
Well, we're going to get to your calls and emails here. And by the way, you can also tweet us. Our Twitter handle is at KQED Forum. And let me just remind myself here that I'm going to be doing an event that some of you may want to know about with Lieutenant Governor Newsom, February 19th, Tuesday, at the Computer History Museum. We'll be in conversation there starting at 7 p.m. And Gavin Newsom will be at the San Francisco Jewish Community Center on the 21st of February at 7 p.m. and on the 27th at the Commonwealth Club at 7:30. Plus at Book Passage in Corte Madera, March 6th at Book Passage. I get to calls here and everything. I got to ask you, though, about since you were doing that TV show with Current Television and Al Gore is going to be on next week, and he's been taking a lot of heat. I mean, Matt Lauer went after him and David Letterman went after him and Jon Stewart went after him. They all said, come on, you know, you're supposed to be Mr. Climate Change and, and you're a sellout, is in effect what they said. You're taking all this money from a major natural gas and petroleum producer. But my experience with Current was a lot of people, first of all, didn't even know where it was or how to find it. Joel Hyatt could never find his way to the studio or to call me back. I didn't know what they were doing. I mean, it seemed to be a strange run operation. But what about selling to Al Jazeera and that whole?
Well, I'll get to that. But, you know, I had a great experience there. I did a show on Friday nights. And, you know, I agree. It was difficult for some to find. But it was in, you know, 60%+ of households across this country. And that was the real value of that network, or the cable deals that Vice President Gore and Joel Hyatt advanced over the last 5 years. So people say, well, how could you get kind of that kind of multiple of revenue, which was relatively modest in terms of the sale price? It was because of the value of those contracts. It would take decades for someone else to do that. Gore, with his connections and the ingenuity of Joel and others, were able to do that in a much
and
faster
forgive me, Al Jazeera also a very first-rate journalist working for
you. Yeah, I think, you know, it was funny. We had someone call in saying, I've been a fan of the show. I can't believe you're working for Al-Qaeda. And you're like, oh, gosh, you know, just the reaction people have. Anything was Al, not Al Gore in this case, but Al Jazeera.
Al Jazeera was in support of Hamas and Hezbollah and certainly against the United States being in Iraq at the time when many of your fellow Democrats were in favor of that.
Yeah. No, look, I think you're right. The English version in particular has gotten a lot of praise. Even Colin Powell said he's an avid watcher. And folks like Hillary Clinton have gone to great lengths to say it's part of the solution in terms of international diplomacy. So it's not an indictment of Al Jazeera per se. But for me, you know, I spent 9 months there. They said there were going to be a sale. My contract was up January 31st anyway. So the timing actually worked perfectly because they're going to a completely different format.
Some of the newspapers implied that you left because
That was wrong. And I mean, literally the contract was up and we fulfilled it. And I was there the last few weeks finishing my last shows. By the way, one of the great shows of all time, an hour with, of all people, Willie Mays, where he opened up to a degree I had not seen in the past. And to your point, I just wish people had seen it or more people had the opportunity, because the one problem with the network is it couldn't financially support marketing outside the network itself. But Jennifer Granholm, Governor Granholm, is still there. She's outstanding. What a remarkable person, and others. But that said, look, I walked in, no heads up. None of us got heads up. This is not an indictment. Obviously, it was a confidential transaction, but none of us are given heads up. I walked in to work to interview a number of folks. The day this was announced, I wondered as I was driving up why all the TV crews were out front. I know Jennifer Granholm was surprised as well, others. So it was a transaction none of us expected. There were rumors in New York Times. There were rumors other networks may pick it up and that may invest a lot of money to keep the same concept going. So this was a surprise to all of us. And as a consequence, I think you'll not see many of the same people that are there today. The issue of Al Gore and the consistency as it relates to his message, particularly the climate change and the like, you know, I get the critique. And he gets it. I mean, you can see he's got a very
deliberate
answer. He's got a standard
boilerplate answer. I understand the criticism. I don't agree with it.
Yeah. No, I, you know, it's a legitimate hit And one can't deny that. But one can also not deny it was a business. It's not a nonprofit. He had investors. They took risk. They made real investments of time and energy into building that network. They tried their best by bringing in CNN talent, David Berman, who was really built CNN. He came in a year ago to dramatically increase the number of programs. That's why I came in, among others. And so they gave it a good shot. And then they had an opportunity, and they took that opportunity in a business transaction. So I can't critique that. Final point. We didn't do enough on the issue that we all should care greatly about, and that's climate change. I had done a show, a full hour on it, and it was interesting conversations. I don't want to talk out of school. But the challenge for us on the issue of the climate change debate is zero ratings. People are just – they intellectually are interested. They'll say, yes, I care. But at the end of the day, they want to see that more polarized, immediate, who's to blame. They want, you know, it's just, it's a slower.
They want the argumentative culture as opposed to, in fact, this goes all the way back to the early ascertainment programs. I remember, you remember Russ Coughlin. You say to me, hey, they want, you know, he was a guy who ran Channel 7 in San Francisco. And you say, they all say they want environmental programs, but they don't want to listen to them.
They don't want to listen to them. No, it was a struggle for all of us.
Except in public radio, because our listeners.
You are the exception.
Well, no, our listeners love these environmental programs we do. And,
I'm with you.
Let me go to our callers. We got a caller, first of all, from Louisville, Kentucky, and that's Eric. Good morning.
Hey.
Hey, how y'all doing?
Okay.
We're good.
First I want to say, Lieutenant Governor, I think it's fantastic how y'all turned everything around with your budget and whatnot in California out there. I think it's great, and I think America as a whole can really sit back and look at that as a great example on, you know, pulling down spending and increasing taxes, and it's going to fix a lot of stuff. A second point I wanted to make, is you wanted to talk about business in California, but the main trafficker of business is the trucks. And y'all have so many regulations on the trucks out there. Truck drivers don't even want to go out there. They want to boycott California because of just a complete over-regulation of what's going on there. Now, I'm a progressive thinker, and I believe in clean energy and cleaning up our planet, and we do need clean trucks and clean stuff like that. But I talked to a physicist in Berkeley up there, and he said by y'all keeping the trucks at 55, you're doing more damage to your roads out there due to keeping the weight and time on the road.
Gee, now Rick Perry's going to say truckers come to Texas.
Well, first, I love Ashley Judd country. Kentucky's getting a lot of attention the last few days, which I think is fun and interesting. A couple points. Thank you for acknowledging, you know, that Democrats can govern in an efficient and effective manner in terms of being fiscally responsible and be good stewards of the tax dollar. I've always maintained this. You don't need to be profligate to be progressive. And I think Governor Brown and the legislature approved that this year. Now we need to prove it yet again and not get carried away with exuberance that things have begun to settle in the state's once again solvent. That said, issue of regulation, legitimate issue. We're going through some CEQA reforms in the state of California that I think are long overdue. But we do pride ourselves in this state, and everyone knows this listening, on our clean air and clean water. We pride ourselves on being on the leading and cutting edge. There's an entrepreneurial spirit here, that pioneering spirit that defines the best of this quote-unquote coast of dreams. And we're leading the way in terms of our international efforts at a statewide level on climate change. AB 32 and its principles are going to be advanced this year for the first year. We're subsequently going to begin the process of marching down that path. With that, there's some bumpy roads, to extend metaphor of trucking. And some of those issues have come not only to the forefront in the state, but even into my office as it relates to air quality issues, as it relates to load and weight, et cetera, that have impacted the trucking industry. And working with the California Air Resources Board and others, and looking at grants and loans, and looking at the ability to shift emission strategies and standards in a way that actually help and not hinder economic growth and the opportunities for small businesses and trucking to survive is certainly a top priority. But it's a bumpy road, and we have to acknowledge that.
And I want to thank Eric for the call. We'll get as many of your calls on as we can with our guest, Gavin Newsom. Michael, you're up. Hi.
Yeah, I completely agree with the point about technology and software being able to solve a lot of the problems, especially in the cost area. But to do that, it takes a lot of quality talent. And, for example, in Silicon Valley, there's already a talent problem and shortage. And then if you look at on the other side, there's a large compensation gap between working in the private sector versus the public sector, where you can make three times as much in the private sector. So how does you help me understand how what the plan would be to solve that compensation back? That compensation gap to make it interesting for talent to actually work for the government.
Well, the question is spot on, and it literally it's answered specifically in the book. Look, the whole idea is this. Right now we have a government that acts like a vending machine. David Kettle years ago wrote about this analogy, and I loved it. The idea of a vending machine is you put in your taxes a dollar, you get police, fire, healthcare, education, defense, but you have limited choices. Someone else is making the determination of what's in the machine. That's the government we have today. It's a framework of scarcity. And if you don't like the machine or what's in the machine, you shake it. The Occupy movement, the Tea Party. What we're looking for and what I'm arguing for with this open government, this government 2.0 framework, is government as a platform. That we recognize the concern of your question, that we can't necessarily solve all our problems. You're right. The problem with talent in the private sector is self-evident. How are you going to get the best and the brightest in the public sector, particularly in information technology? And the answer is we won't. We're not going to be able to compete in that respect. So it's all about opening up this platform to third-party developers. It's about taking information, putting up online the same way that Steve Jobs looked at the iPhone. Steve Jobs didn't put together 800,000 apps that exist on the iPhone platform today. He only did about 12. He said, we're not in the apps business. We're going to open that up to the private sector. And that's the way I see a framework of abundance. It's the way I see a framework of government in the future. It's trying to create a framework of engagement with citizen developers and with the private sector to initiate a lot of these solutions, particularly as it relates to the ubiquity of the cloud, the move to mobility, and the opportunities to engage with those that have the expertise to solve problems at a local, state, and national level.
Let me thank the caller and go to some of your emails and web postings. Marshall writes, Gavin Newsom gets it. I'm Wayne S. on our Facebook page. Is Mr. Newsom's book available for digital download? Figured I'd ask since we're on the topic.
How can you write a book about digital technology and not have it? So you can go online today and pick it up. Thank you.
Here's Amber who says, I'm 24 and I think my generation is going to be more politically engaged because of social pressure brought on by Facebook and Twitter. Election Day was full of posts about the ballot measures and reminders to vote. I work for political campaigns, listen to political talk radio, sign petitions online, and share political articles on my wall. I'm engaged and informed because of social media.
That's right.
On the other hand, here's Bob who writes on our website, Gavin is very naive if he thinks a creative hacker culture can suddenly be dropped upon the state bureaucracy. As an engineer for the state with 25 years of service, I've seen my department gradually degenerate from being somewhat receptive to ideas from staffers to being a totally top-down, rigid hierarchy with too often a kiss-up, kick-down attitude by managers. A few apps aren't going to cure this. The only way is for the governor's office ultimately to accept some amount of disharmony and chaos in the state departments that allows multiple voices instead of a single soothing party line voice.
I'm with him. I like that. And I completely agree. But to wit my point, I'm a hard-headed pragmatist. I certainly am an idealist, but I want to manifest those ideals. I don't want to talk about the way the world should be. So it's not just about a few simple apps. Look, hierarchy's dead. One-way conversations are dead. We're just on borrowed time right now. The whole notion that big is getting small is self-evident when you think about the Arab Spring, when you think about these armies of Davids that are using slingshots now of technology to tear down Goliath, big organizations. I noted the media. We talked about the issue of music industry. You're seeing it with large institutions in the private sector, and you're seeing the contours of a totally new shift and change taking place. And it's generational in many respects, but it's also an attitude, not a time of life, but a state of mind, as Bobby Kennedy said. And so what I believe in is devolving and evolving, is collaboration, co-production. What I believe in is decentralization. And those are the core tenets that require, you're right, leadership, not just from the top, but side by side, bottom up.
Well, that's what you call the hybrid. You call
it's a hybrid
voter
model.
And politician essentially hybrid. Tom tweets, 50% of millennials are unemployed or underemployed. Time to rethink labor strategy.
No, I agree with that. It goes back to my economic imperative in terms of change. We have to ask, we talk about Tom Friedman. I love in his last book, it used to be us. He says the one question he never hears asked in Washington, D.C., let alone Sacramento or in a city hall anywhere in the United States is, what world are we living in? What are the trend lines that define this
world?
I thought
it was a flat world.
Well, at his point, it's no longer flat. He talked about it being connected, but now he talks about it being hyper-connected. Hyper-connected and hyper-partisan, undoubtedly. But in a hyper-connected world, where things are made literally in the world, not made in California, not made in the United States, we've got to dramatically alter our mindset of how we adopt an approach from a governmental policy perspective and engagement into building the next economy. We're not having those debates. We're still arguing for yesterday's manufacturing in a world where right now Autodesk in San Francisco is literally printing out through additive manufacturing technology, 3D printing. Well, you name it. The point being, the world has changed dramatically, and it's about to change exponentially so again. And we are on the cutting edge, as I talk about in the book, of 1973, a 20th century bureaucracy in a 21st century world. We have to wake up to that reality.
Our guest again is Gavin Newsom. His new book is written with Lisa Dickey, Citizenville, How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Let me go to some more of your comments from a Facebook page. Zach writes, just a thought, San Francisco should create a Facebook page to notify citizens of road closures. This would save people time and fuel while reducing congestion and pollution. Think of how often 9th and Larkin are backed up due to a festival by City Hall. Better use of automation via computers and social media could reduce time spent in bureaucracies like DPT and, for heaven's sake, make the DMV website functional and user-friendly.
He's a man after my own heart. Amen.
A lot of men and women after your own heart here. In fact, here's Kim who says, great interview with Gavin Newsom. I loved hearing all the ways California excels, but there is one area we rate at the very bottom among all the states, yeah. Voter participation. Just 55% of our eligible voters cast ballots in the November 2012 presidential election. What does Mr. Newsom think California ought to do to turn this around?
No, I don't want to say it. God, I sound like the guy with the book. I am the person with the book. Read my book. I begin with this disconnect, and then I spend 7-8 chapters trying to explain what you want me to explain in the next 10 seconds. And that is the only way to change it is to be open, transparent, and build trust. Elections are just one step in the equation. We spent all our time and energy caring about you to get elected. And the minute, as I said, we get elected, we then broadcast to you for 4 more years and then once again engage in a two-way conversation. That doesn't work anymore.
You have to have a stake.
That's got to change.
You have to have a stake from the citizens, too, that they feel they're going to make a difference, that they feel by being engaged they can make a difference.
Yeah, and we go through dozens and dozens of examples of cities that are truly having real engagement. I mean, where we're doing deliberative poll, not just deliberate polling, but we're doing budgets where people literally, Brazil's a great example. Brazil's put up tens of millions of dollars and they've created a framework where people are able to actually decide for themselves where those dollars go. There's ways of really engaging people where it's not just some suggestion box that gets burned, where you never know that anyone actually read any of the suggestions, where there's a real conversation, an iterative two-way conversation, where there's real co-collaboration, where there's a real co-authorship in terms of that engagement and solutions.
I keep talking about the millennials and the younger generation. Democratic Party has a pretty young and diverse base, but an older and whiter leadership structure. Brown, Feinstein, Boxer, Buck, Burton. Where's another generation get a chance?
Yeah, I'll go back to my Bobby Kennedy quote. The world needs are the qualities of youth, not a time of life, but a state of mind. I want to be generous and fair to my friends. Yeah, it is interesting. But, 80 is the new 40. These folks are young. I mean, John Burton just had his 80th birthday, and he's as vibrant as anyone. Dianne Feinstein, it's remarkable.
These are not your typical 80-year-olds.
No, so. But I'm impressed. So my point is that we have atypical, outstanding leadership. And for me, again, it's not your age. I mean, look at Jerry Brown. He's as youthful as any. I mean, he's got a jump in a step even before Prop 30 passed, but certainly now post Prop 30. And so I admire folks that are willing to listen and evolve and be entrepreneurial in their thinking.
I think just between you and me and the thousands of listeners here, it helped Jerry found Ann in his life.
Well, that's an understatement.
Put step in his life.
The co-governor.
You're a UC Region. You're a CSU trustee.
Yes.
There's been a political push in Sacramento, particularly in recent weeks, against any tuition or fee hikes. So what do you think?
Well, that's been – you asked the division with the governor and I. It was my frustration that I started to express a little more publicly about all those cuts to
higher
education.
As you did on this program. But I'm wondering what you think about the GOP bill now at the state capitol to freeze tuition for 7 years.
I don't think it's – I don't believe in prescriptive top-down legislation that hinders the ability to be flexible and nimble in a world that is defined by the ability to adapt. My point being this, you can't statically say you can't do something when conditions may – that's equivalent to signing one of those darn pledges. I mean, something dramatic may happen where it's required of us to make dramatic decisions that either alter the number of people that can access a system or would compensate for that by potentially increasing fees. So I don't particularly like that. That said, I voted against these fee increases, and I think we're doing a mediocre job at best at looking at alternative ways to educate people. You talk about a broadcast model. The last 150 years, the education system hasn't changed. Honestly, if someone literally came back to life today, they'd see the exact same classroom that they saw 150 years ago. You can't have, I mean, Sal Khan, these guys, they get it.
That's a whole revolution though.
But it's real. And you know what? It makes the issue of tenure and seniority, those debates are so dull, so stale. I listen to all these people screaming and yelling at each other and creating these organizations and billionaires spending all this money on trivia. You want to get serious about education reform? You can't reform it. You got to redesign it to something completely different than it is today. You've got to look at blended learning. You've got to look at flipping the classroom. You've got to look at these tools of technology to completely shift the mindset of how we engage in a more Socratic way, a mentorship model of educating folks, not by age cohorts, not by date of manufacture, meaning everyone's the exact same age, going subject to subject in a regimented way, the way we did during the feudal to industrial economy. It's comical, the debates we're having. I say, with respect to all those that are well-intentioned, give me a break.
If you've just joined us, we're talking to technophile Gavin Newsom, also Lieutenant Governor of the State of California. You're listening to Forum. This is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller here, and that's Sharon from San Francisco. Good morning.
Good morning. I've always had this vision of having the budget actually online on a line-by-line basis where you can click on any given item and go to a discussion forum where people can actually discuss the pros and cons. Do you think that would ever see the light of day, something like that?
Yeah, no, the private sector, and we have examples in the book of where the private sector has adopted some interesting, there's a budgetchallenge.org that does that at California, and you can go and you can make decisions and see how those decisions impact the rest of the budget. You're given a set of facts and you can participate. The problem with that is it doesn't necessarily make its way into the governor's office, doesn't make its way into the decision maker's hands in the Department of Finance, and that's the disconnect. So you're absolutely right. Look, we lack complete transparency as it relates to the budget. It is opaque. It's difficult to actually navigate, even for those that are in office. My gosh. So that said, we specifically lay out some ideas to dramatically open up the budget and do this, because this is most important. People don't want to know information in silos. They want to know information in subject matters, in interest. Good example. Last year in the State of the Union, we're going to have the State of the Union next Tuesday. The president had a wonderful comment. He said, we have 12 agencies that are responsible for exports. We have 5 agencies responsible for housing. And he said, this is my favorite. It was a good applause line. He said, the Interior Department is responsible for salmon when they're in freshwater, but the Commerce Department's responsible for salmon when they're in saltwater. And he says, we can't win the future with a government from the past. An exact quote. Well, today we have 12 agencies dealing with exports, 5 agencies dealing with housing. Interior, with a new director soon from REI, is still responsible for freshwater salmon. And Commerce, who's now going to be Penny Pritzker, is going to be responsible for those same salmon in saltwater. So the rhetoric is good, and I'm a huge supporter of the president, and no one's done more on the open data movement than President Obama. But we got to get serious about this, and I think there's a recognition, but we've got to actually manifest those realities with some substantive change.
Well, I've got a listener named Gavin who sends this following email. Uh-oh. And says, we started off earlier on talking about Rick
Perry.
He may
be very angry. People bring my name up to him when he's called.
Well, we can find that.
Gavin,
we can pursue that with some research, perhaps. But he says, I frequently hear the claim that California companies are moving to Texas, yet I never hear any statistics.
Yeah. In fact, you can go to the San Francisco Chronicle today. Andrew Ross wrote a wonderful piece and made the case of Texas companies that have moved to San Francisco and California companies that have moved to Texas. Again, it's not a huge percentage, but it gets a ton publicity. And I'll tell you, I'm arguing for structural changes in economic development strategies, and I'm arguing for a messaging campaign. We do a terrible job messaging our success. Caterpillar, Samsung, success with Dell coming into California. We have Amazon in their call centers coming into California, or their distribution centers. There are a lot of things to be prideful about, but they don't get the attention in the headlines. It takes, I think, a very different approach and mindset coming out of Sacramento in this case to begin to change that perception, which ultimately then for some becomes reality.
We asked on our social media for ideas on how government can better use technology, and here's some of those responses. I just want to let you know about them. Emma says government should let us vote using an app on our mobile devices. And how about an app to see what your state rep is voting on? You can send your yes or no vote to them and then see how the reps voted. And Urban San Jose tweets, improve voting registration and polling equipment, or better yet, enable people to vote online with identity verification.
These are in the book. These are fabulous people with fabulous examples. These are things we can do. And by the way, are being done. Estonia, my gosh, Estonia allows you to vote online. Heck, you pay all your parking tickets and fines online. You've been able to do that for decades. You know, Estonia has 200% penetration rate with cell phones and smartphones, meaning the average person has two cell phones or smartphones. They skipped a whole generation. And that's, by the way, the great challenge with government in America.
We're looking to Estonia now as a paradigm?
Well, I know. Estonia is a model. As they say, the American dream of technological reform is live and well in Estonia. By the way, that's literally the first story in the book is my interview with the president of Estonia. And I was trying to impress him with my new Wi-Fi proposal that ultimately got caught up in politics in San Francisco, and he looked at me cross-eyed and said, what the heck are you talking about? We've been doing that for decades.
Well, that's a very telling anecdote right there. Kevin, good to see you. Good to have you on.
Good to be here. Thanks for
Kevin Newsom, our guest this hour. Again, the book is, and you can learn a lot from this book, as you can obviously tell. Citizenville is the title. The subtitle is How to Take the Town Square Digital and Reinvent Government. Forum is produced by Judy Campbell and Irene Gucci. Production assistance from Tina Lauerberg. Our engineer is Danny Bringer. And our engagement producer, handling all these technical things, is Amanda Stupai, with online support from David Marks. Senior editor is Dan Zoll, and executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.